9:47 is the time. It's Dean Richards Sunday morning on WGN. Lots of comment, lots of talk. The subject of the Republican debate last night, part of the subject of the debate last night, the sudden and surprising death of Justice Antonin Scalia. Remembering Justice Scalia this morning, a colorful character, I will certainly say, a legal scholar by all accounts. And, you know, people have very strong opinions on him for, you know, one side or the other on this. Wanted to chat with some of the people who knew Justice Scalia and could give us a little bit of insight. Among those, Joseph Carney, who is the dean and professor of law at Marquette University in Milwaukee and a former law clerk to Justice Scalia. Mr. Carney, welcome to the show. Nice to have you with us. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
When did you first meet Justice Scalia?
I was practicing law in Chicago in the early 1990s, and I had an interview in Washington, D.C. with him for a clerkship in August of 1994. I guess the conversation went well enough that I served as one of his law clerks during the October 1995 term. These are one-year clerkships.
Yeah, so what was that like for you? You know, I assume a young attorney, you know, getting started, and suddenly the clerk to a U.S. Supreme Court justice.
It was a rather extraordinary year. It no doubt would have been clerking for anyone on the court, but I think that folks who knew him and even those who were not his law clerks in the building regarded the opportunity to work with Justice Scalia and to learn from him as really the most unique opportunity that one could have there. I went into it a little bit skeptical, not that I would be impressed or that I would enjoy him, but that he could be quite as impressive as his former clerks with whom I had spoken made him out to be. I had practiced for a few years, whereas most people going into these clerkships are coming maybe a year out of law school, and I had worked for some really remarkable lawyers, and I thought to myself, well, he can't be, you know, all that they're saying. He was all that and more.
In what way?
He was this very remarkable combination of someone who had a tremendous personality. He was a native New Yorker and very much embodied the spirit of that city in terms of his zest for life and his sense of humor and that sort of thing. On the other hand, he was a brilliant lawyer and former law professor. I don't think that there's much doubt that he was the most gifted rhetorician ever to serve on the United States Supreme Court. That's a pretty strong statement, given such people as Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. or Justice Robert Jackson. So it was the combination of these various facets of his personality that came together, and as one of the nine members of the court, he certainly had an outsized effect on the trajectory of the American law over the past 30 years.
Yeah, I think that's definitely something for which we all can agree. And even people who disagreed with some of his opinions, who were not as conservative as him in some of his opinions, agree that his knowledge of the Constitution, that being, you know, as a legal scholar, was among the best.
Right. He really did treat his colleagues in his personal relations, and this was true of them with him as well. I do not think he was unique in this regard, with considerable respect when it came to stating his differences in written opinions concerning the law. His view was that he should be direct with them in that regard, and to the extent that the other side had good arguments and they could persuade him, he would say, those are good arguments and I'm persuaded. Obviously, over the course of 30 years, the way that the court works is that many of the issues with which it's dealing are ones that have come before it before in one form or another, and so it does become possible to predict with some degree of certainty how various justices on the court are going to come down on different cases. And so it is not the case that the justices, for whatever acrimony may be present in the written opinions do not get along well, at least in my experience during that 1 year. I was very impressed by all nine of them.
Yeah, and much has been said about Justice Scalia's relationship with Justice Ginsburg, with whom philosophically they completely disagreed on things, but apparently we're pretty close buds, it sounds like.
They were, and that was true of their families as well. They had been judges together on the United States Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, and Marty Ginsburg, the late Marty Ginsburg, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's husband, and Maureen Scalia, all four of them were good friends. But it wasn't just Justice Ginsburg. One of the newest members of the court, indeed the newest member of the court, is Justice Elena Kagan, and she had been the dean at Harvard Law School and then the Solicitor General of the United States. So she is from a different generation from Justice Scalia, and she had immense respect and affection for Justice Scalia. She was here at Marquette Law School a few years ago and told the story of Justice Scalia's persuading her to go out hunting with him. And I don't know that Justice Kagan, who also is a New Yorker, as is Justice Ginsburg, there are several of them on the court, ever would have envisioned herself hunting.
But that was not the case, though, with his relationship with Sandra Day O'Connor, at least in the beginning. From what I've read, their relationship was a little bit contentious.
Well, it was contentious with respect to the written opinion. They were both Reagan appointees, Justice O'Connor having been appointed earlier than Justice Scalia, and they had rather different judicial philosophies, even though there were elements of conservatism in both of them. Justice Scalia was very much someone who liked to find a rule that he could then apply neutrally and to try to strip the law to the extent possible and appropriate of judicial discretion. Justice O'Connor was considerably more interested in the equities as she would see them, and so I think it was inevitable in terms of their jurisprudence that they were going to end up on the different side of various issues, including to some extent abortion, for example. At the same time, to judge at least from the 1 year that I was there, 1995 to 1996, I never saw anything on the personal level that suggested that jurisprudential differences spilled over into unhappy personal relations.
Explain this notion of a living constitution to which Justice Scalia was said to have been opposed. What does that mean, the notion of a living constitution?
The question frequently for Supreme Court justices is what to do with the relatively vague phrases in the Constitution. So some things are clear. The right in the federal context only to be subject to the criminal law through the indictment of a grand jury, for example. There's little dispute about that. But then there are many other phrases in the Constitution that require some other means besides the mere text to give them content. The Due Process Clause, what is due process of law? To some extent, the Equal Protection Clause, what is equal protection of law? What does it mean to be subject to cruel and unusual punishment? So you have these relatively vague phrases, and the question is, how are we going to give them content? And there are several ways of doing it. One way of doing it is to look to what the original framers of the Constitution or of the 14th Amendment in the 1860s, as the case may have been, would have thought to be due process of law or equal protection or cruel and unusual punishment, and to hew rather closely to the original understanding or intent of the framers. That was Justice Scalia's approach. The proponents of the living Constitution, and the late Justice William Brennan would have been in the forefront of this, would say, no, we should look to what the evolving consensus of society today has to say about what it means for there to be due process or what it means to have a prescription against cruel and unusual punishment. And the difficulty for Justice Scalia and others who are proponents of originalism is that that gives judges an awful lot of discretion with respect to what they find to be permitted or prohibited by the Constitution. Justice Scalia wanted to limit the role of the judiciary in order to ensure that the political branches, the executive and the legislative branches at both the federal and the state levels, had adequate discretion with which to govern.
The one of the issues that's come up now, you know, within hours of the death of Justice Scalia, was the manner in which his replacement will be announced. What's your take as a law professor, as somebody who's you know, in the profession, that it, you know, may take over a year to finally get someone to get the business of the Supreme Court back up and running again?
Right. This is probably better for a political science professor than a law professor, but it will, the evidence suggests at this point, take a while. To be sure, it will only matter in the especially close cases. Now, admittedly, that's an important set of cases that might be 4-4 at the moment with Justice Scalia's death. The court has certainly, over the course of time, operated on occasion with less than a full complement, but it does cause real strain on the court. Some cases may end up having to be reset for next term, and then, as you say, it's not at all clear that even at the beginning of next term there will be a justice serving. So the court is going to be in the spotlight of the presidential race, it would seem, in a way that is ordinarily not the case. There are always references to the court in presidential campaigns, but they tend to be background statements, yeah, or ancillary statements. Here it's going to be at the forefront.
I just wonder, because Justice Scalia was such a proponent of the, you know, of following the word of the law so strictly, that the attempt now by the Republicans, and I know that this is, I'm not asking you to be political in this, I'm just saying, doesn't it kind of fly in the face of Justice Scalia's strict interpretation of the law to wait a year to name his replacement? The formula for this is quite clear. It's quite clear and written. It seems like that's something that Justice Scalia would be in favor of.
It's clear in the sense that it's the responsibility of the president to nominate a successor. It is also clear at the same time that it's the prerogative of the Senate to either give or to withhold its consent to that person serving on the court. And so it's not a simple matter of the legislative branch getting in the way of some executive prerogative. The Constitution gives responsibilities and some discretion to both the President and the United States Senate here. So it's not altogether clear-cut, if I may, along the lines of the suggestion.
I appreciate you joining us, Joseph Kearney, who's a professor of law, a dean at Marquette University, and from what I read on your Wikipedia page, a White Sox fan. Is that correct?
Yes, I am a Southsider who finds himself here in Milwaukee over the past two decades. It works out okay, though, because I have even greater antipathy for the Chicago Cubs than the Milwaukee Brewers fans do. So I'm at home here.
Thank you for joining us. We appreciate it. Joseph Kearney. More on the death of Justice Scalia coming up.